Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live, of course, for a half hour each weekday morning. If you'd like to call in, you can reach me with your questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. You call that number and we will be able to talk to you about the questions you have about the Bible or about the Christian faith. If you live in Southern California or will be in Southern California this weekend, I will be speaking again on the subject of Toward a Radically Christian Counterculture, continuing a series. If you haven't caught the earlier lectures, it doesn't matter. We'll, each lecture is standalone, has value. I will be in Temecula this Saturday speaking, and you can get information from our website about that. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Now, if you've been to our earlier meetings in Temecula, they've been held at a variety of locations as we've been looking for the best place to accommodate the size of the group that we draw. And this time we'll be at another location, different than before. We're going to actually be renting a room at the Temecula Free Methodist Church. So you, if you've gone to the meetings before, don't just assume they're in the same place. They're not. This Saturday, I'll be in Temecula speaking on the subject, Toward a Radically Christian Counterculture, once again, at a new location. Information, address, and all that can be found at the website, thenarrowpath.com, at the link that says Announcements. We're going to talk, first of all, today to Theo from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Theo. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have two questions. The first one, I guess, is how would someone who's into openness theology, how would they explain the foreknowledge of God? But say, even specifically, like when Jesus predicted how Peter would deny him before the cock crows and things like that.
Well, some of our listeners may not know that openness theology is a theological system that indicates that God is open to different developments that may come about from human choice and free will, and therefore that the future is not determined and is open to different possibilities. Now, if it is open like that, then they say that God, of course, can't really know what's going to happen except for those things that he makes happen. Of course, God makes many things happen, but openness theologians believe that God doesn't make everything happen. God doesn't make me make a decision to sin, for example. That's something that I determine. And so they would say that God does know all the future things that he plans to do that are part of his purpose, but he doesn't know the things we're going to do in response to him. And he will respond wisely to whatever we end up doing, and his purposes will be fulfilled anyway. But he doesn't necessarily know what we're going to do. That's what openness theologians say. Now, one of the great weaknesses of that view, I think, comes when you try to reconcile it with the very point you made, Jesus predicting Peter's denial. Jesus predicted that Peter would deny him three times before the cock would crow on the evening of Jesus' betrayal. And it happened, just the way Jesus said. Even though Peter was determined that it wouldn't happen, Jesus said it would, and it did. Now, these are examples of Peter making choices. You know, to deny Christ is a moral choice. And Jesus was able to predict accurately that he would make those moral choices. This looks like a very good example of God knowing the future, of God knowing what people will do before they do it. And to my mind, it's one of the strongest examples of God predicting what a man would do before he did it. Now, the openness theologians, in response to that challenge, usually will say that it's not so much that Christ could see the future or that God could see the future as it was that they could, that God could see Peter's overconfidence, that Peter, he knew how weak Peter was. He knew what Peter would succumb to. He could perfectly assess the strength and weakness of Peter's resolve and so forth, and therefore he could estimate quite accurately what Peter would do under certain circumstances. but I have a hard time accepting that explanation, to tell you the truth. It seems to me that if Jesus said Peter would do those things, this couldn't just be an estimation. Peter, in fact, would have to do them, or else Jesus would be a false prophet.
So many other players, the people who accused him of being a disciple and things like that.
Right. So what I'm saying is that I don't think the openness theologians have a very compelling answer to that problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And my second question is, I've heard some lectures from a preterist, and I'm wondering if preterism is true, is there anything to look forward to?
Well, it depends on what kind of preterism you're thinking of.
I'm talking full preterist.
Okay, yeah. A full preterist does not believe there will ever be an end of the world or a second coming of Jesus or a resurrection of the dead. They believe the world goes on and on forever, and that each generation will live its own life, face its own tests. You know, each individual either decide for or against Christ. And if you decide for Christ, then when you die, you go to heaven. And when you, or if you decide against Christ, you don't go to heaven. And the earth just goes on and on. To me, that doesn't sound very much like what the Bible teaches. And I mean, the Bible, on this view, of course, there is never any really a final end to sin. There's not a final end to history in God's favor. It's just an endless succession of generations, each having their own turn. But there's no obvious purpose in having the world or bringing it to a conclusion that is very satisfactory, at least as near as I can tell. And that's one of the things I don't like, of course, about full preterism. There's other things I don't like about it too, but I don't care for some of the ways in which they interpret Scripture. But the overall picture of God never really finally conquering all things and putting an end to the career of sin and Satan and so forth is something that I don't really see how they can derive that from Scripture.
Yeah, so I think I agree with you. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Steve.
Good talking to you. Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're talking next to Kathy from Denver, Colorado. Kathy, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm calling because I want to just see, I'm actually driving, so I won't be able to stay on the line, but I'll listen to your response over the air. I wanted to see if you could explain Ephesians 3:2 a little better to me about the dispensations of grace.
Okay, well, that's fine. If you need to get off the phone, go ahead. I'll go ahead and discuss that.
Thank you so much.
Kathy,
appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. Yeah, in Ephesians chapter 3, Paul says in verse 2, if indeed you have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God, which was given to me for you, how that by revelation he made known to me the mystery, as I wrote before in a few words, by which when you read, you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ. Now, I think maybe it's the word dispensation that you're interested in. I'm not sure because you didn't clarify, but Paul says, he uses the term the dispensation of the grace of God. And we live in a time where evangelicals often hear about dispensations, especially from the camp called dispensationalism, that teaches that there are different periods of time in God's redemptive history, different dispensations, which are marked by a beginning and an end, and there are a series of these dispensations, and in each of them, God is working something a little differently, has a slightly different arrangement with people. And on the dispensational view, we are living now in what's called the dispensation of grace, meaning a period of time during which God is administering grace for salvation, as opposed to some previous time when they think he was administering salvation through the law or through some other arrangement. And so they say that the church age is the dispensation of grace as opposed to other times. Now, this verse uses the words dispensation of the grace of God, so that some might think that Paul is using this the way the dispensationalists are using it. However, the Greek word dispensation, the Greek word behind this English word dispensation, is a word that means the management of a household or stewardship. The word dispensation can best probably be translated as stewardship. And Paul is not using this word to mean a period of time. He's talking about his own stewardship of his ministry. God has given him the stewardship of something, just as every person in ministry is given responsibility. So he's been given the responsibility to steward or to manage something. And what he's been given to steward is the grace of God. He says, if you have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God, which was given to me. Notice, the dispensation of the grace of God was given to him. This is not talking about a period of time, an age of the church or whatever, which was not given to Paul, of course. But it's talking about a stewardship of the grace of God that was given to him. Just like everybody has got to be a good steward of the grace of God that's given to them. To say that I've been given a stewardship of the grace of God is simply to say that I'm a Christian and God has given a manifestation of his grace in my life in the form of what are called gifts of grace. And I have a responsibility to manage that. And so did Paul. Peter talks that way in 1 Peter chapter 4. In verse 10 and 11, he says, as each one has received a gift, and in the Greek this word gift is a gift of grace. It's a charisma, which means a gift of grace. As each one has received a gift of grace, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Now what he's saying is each of us has received an endowment, a gift of grace from God. These gifts of grace are what we call the charismatic gifts that Paul lists in 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12 and other places. And each person has received some gift of grace, and the giving of that gift to you defines a responsibility that God has given to you to use it for the ministry to the saints. And your use of it to minister is your fulfilling your stewardship. So Paul also had a gift of grace from God, and he had a stewardship responsibility. And he said, I want you to know of the stewardship of the grace of God that God has given me. So he's not really talking about dispensations in the sense that dispensationalists talk about them. He's simply talking about the stewardship of his own spiritual gift when he says the dispensation of the grace of God that was given to me in Ephesians 3:2. So we don't have in this verse any kind of support for the idea of dispensations, such as dispensationalists use the word, but he's simply making a statement which, if the word dispensation had been translated perhaps more fortuitously as stewardship, which is what the word means, we would have had less confusion about it. We can talk next to Chris from San Diego, California. Hi, Chris. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Okay, so I have a question concerning Luke chapter 19, and I'm sure you can put this in context for me, but the main verse that kind of is going to be difficult to navigate through is verse 27, where Jesus is giving a story of, it's an analogy of faithfulness, I believe, in this story from 11 to verse 27. And at the final verse, he says, but these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slay them in my presence. So can you shed some light on that and just give it, you know, a little bit of a contextual understanding for me?
Well, the story begins with a nobleman who is going away to receive a kingdom, and he leaves his goods in the care of some of his servants to be stewards of them, as we were just talking about stewardship with the previous call. His citizens didn't want him to be their king, and they said, we won't have this man reign over us. But he went away and left the management of the goods with his servants. And when he came back, he rewarded his servants who had been faithful in the stewardship, and he also punished those people who had refused to accept his kingship. Now, as I understand this, this is an analogy, of course, of Christ himself, who went to heaven to be awarded his royal position. We see this in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13, I think 12 and 13, if I'm not mistaken, in Daniel 7, where it says, he saw the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven to the Ancient of Days, and he was given dominion and a kingdom and a throne. So when Jesus ascended into heaven, he came to his Father, and he was given a throne. He sat down at the right hand of God. And so this nobleman going away to receive a kingdom is Christ, I think, ascending into heaven to be enthroned there, which he now is, of course. But before he left, there were two reactions people had to him. Some rejected him as their king. Now, this would be probably the Jews who said, we have no king but Caesar, and wanted him crucified. And then there were those who had received him and were his servants, and he gave them stewardship of things to do. So that's us today. Today, while Jesus is away, we have a responsibility to steward the things he's put in our hands to use for his kingdom's sake. Now, at the end, he comes back, which I think is the future second coming of Christ. And he rewards his servants for their stewardship, and he punishes those who have rejected his kingship. So that's a pretty standard view of the second coming of Christ. You know, Jesus comes to judge, to reward the righteous, and to punish the wicked. And I think that this parable is simply making that point.
One of the things that I guess I would want some clarity on is it mentions slay them in my presence as if he were commanding someone else to perform that judgment.
Well, in the story, he's a king, and he himself, you know, a king usually would not go out and execute the criminals in his domain with his own hand. He would order that to his officers. I don't know the officers who carry this out figure as parallels to anyone in particular. Maybe the angels. I don't know, but it's not really necessary to say who does the execution, because actually, the executioners are not named or identified even in the story. It's just the king gives an order to have them slain. So, I mean, in the trappings of the story, the king would probably give the order to his bodyguards or to his military officials or someone to go out and to kill his enemies. But in reality, the point is not being focused on as to who does the execution so much as that those who rejected his rulership will suffer those consequences when he comes back.
Okay. Yeah, it's just one of these verses that I definitely want to make sure. I'm actually leading a small group study tonight, and this is my chapter, and I've got to get some clarity on this, because I definitely want to balance it with the fact that Jesus taught to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Well, there's no suggestion here that the punishment is coming on those who persecuted his people, although they might have. That's not part of the story. The story is that they were God's enemies, or they were the king's enemies, and the king executed his enemies, and that Jesus will judge his enemies when he comes back seems to be a fairly consistent theme in the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just that I'm sure somebody could isolate this verse and run away with their own, you know, presupposition about God and his mercy or lack thereof. And so that's kind of why I want to. I like how
It certainly is not a unique case. I mean, the story of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25, 31 and following is also a picture of Jesus judging all people when he comes back, and sending some of them into what's referred to as eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. That there is a judgment of the wicked is not something the Bible is shy about mentioning. And it's not contrary to the character of God. Of course, the nature of that judgment is controversial. You know, as you know, you probably know there are different views of hell. And so what becomes of these people once they're thrown into the lake of fire is something that has been discussed from different possible angles. But that there is a lake of fire doesn't seem to be. Yeah, that there is a lake of fire doesn't seem to be questionable.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I wrote those verses down, Daniel 7 and Matthew 25. So I will check those out and correspond those along with this section here.
Okay, Chris. Thanks for your call.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day. God bless you.
God bless you. Good talking to you. All right. Our next call is from Marty in San Diego. Another call from San Diego. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Marty. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Steve, I got a question about, it's over in Proverbs 30, verse 4.
Okay.
And actually, verse 5 says, every word of God is pure. Well, verse 4 begins with, who hath ascended up into heaven, or descended, who hath gathered the wind in his fists, who hath bound the waters in a garment, who hath established all the ends of the earth, what is his name and what is his son's name, if thou canst tell. And it seems to me like over in John 3:13, Jesus is correcting that statement because he says there, and no man hath ascended up into heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man which is in heaven. Do you believe Jesus was making a correction in that statement to, because Proverbs 34 says first that who hath ascended or descended, and we know Jesus first descended and then ascended.
Okay, well, first of all, I don't see Proverbs 30, verse 4, the way many people do. Many people think that it is referring to God or to Jesus in this place, and I don't think so. I think that Agur, the writer of this chapter, is raising a rhetorical question. He's not saying that anybody has or has ascended or descended. He's, in effect, saying no one has. he's asking rhetorically, who has done that? And the answer is, of course, nobody. Who has ascended into heaven or descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fist? Well, no man can do that. Who has bound the waters in a garment? Well, no man can do that. Who has established the ends of the earth? Well, no man can do that. Now, of course, we know the answer is God has done that, but that's not the point that Agur is bringing up. What Agur is saying is, among men, who is there who has such powers and qualifications to speak? He's talking about, in the context, how he doesn't know the great mysteries. And he's saying, I think, neither does anyone else. I think he's saying that there are great mysteries that only God could know and no man could know. And speaking of men, I think he's saying, well, who among men? I'm adding the words among men because I believe that's implied in his flow of thought. Among men, who has ascended or descended? The implication is nobody has, and therefore no one is really a master of the great mysteries. Who has gathered the wind in his fist? Who has bound the waters in his garment? Who has established the ends of the earth? No man has done those things. So how could any man answer the ultimate mysteries of life? I think that's what Agur is getting at. And when
I
he
totally
says,
agree.
What is
that's
his name?
An outstanding, excellent observation. Thank you for letting me in on that. Appreciate you.
Okay, Marty. God bless
Thank you.
Uh-huh. And I might just say this, too, because some people go further with this. And because the verse ends, what is his name and what is his son's name, if you know? And because many Christians assume that Agur is talking about God here, even the New King James capitalizes the his, when it says, what is his name, as if it's talking about God. And what is his son's name, they capitalize that too, his son is talking about God's son. That could be confusing if you're looking at a translation that does that. The capitalization is not in the Hebrew. Agur is not saying what is God's name and what is his son's name. Many people have used this to say that, see, the Old Testament proves that God has a son. Well, no doubt God does have a son, but that's not proven in this verse. Agur is not making any point about God. He's making point about men. And he's simply throwing up a challenge to any man. Is there anyone out there who's been up to heaven and back, you know, that we should listen to you and believe that you know all the mysteries? Has anyone here established the earth or gathered the waters in the garment? I'd like to know who that is. I'd like to even meet his son if he's out there. Now, he's not talking about God. He's throwing out a challenge to the mass of humanity out there, saying, who has the qualifications? I'd even be glad to hear who his son is. You know, I mean, anyone who's done those things, maybe I don't have access to him, but I'd be glad to just talk to his son. Now, what he's just saying, he's being a little bit caustic and cynical here. He's saying that people who claim to know all the mysteries of the universe are claiming too much, because nobody has really the experience. Nobody has been up to heaven to get this information. And John is saying the same thing in John chapter 3. No man has ascended into heaven, but the Son, who has come down, has declared God. When it says no man has ascended to heaven, it's not really, what it's saying is that if you want to find some authority to speak on the things of heaven, you won't find a man who's been there and back to tell you. But Jesus has come down from there. That's really what it's saying in John chapter 3. And I believe also that's what it's, it's the same idea in Proverbs, that people don't have ultimate knowledge. God alone has ultimate knowledge, of course, but that's not what he's bringing up. He's pointing out that man doesn't know. There's a lot of mysteries man cannot answer because man doesn't have God's prerogatives. And show me the man who's done those things, Agur says. Or just show me his son. That'd be good enough just to see him. And I realize that many people use this verse to prove the idea from the Old Testament that God has a son. But this is not a good verse to prove that. I would rather use Isaiah 9:6 or Psalm 2:7. But anyway, Marty, I appreciate your call and all of you who've called. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Again, I want to remind those of you in Southern California, I'll be speaking in Temecula this Saturday. Temecula. You can find the information at our website, thenarrowpath.com, at the announcements link. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. We pay the radio stations for the time we use, and we get the money that we pay them with from listeners alone. And if you like to hear the program stay on the air where you're listening, we do have to pay. If you'd like to help support us, you may go some of the distance in helping us stay on the air. You can check our website about that, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.